Hello, Kate Lamb here, and you're listening to Asia Calling. Coming up on the show this week, LGBT rights in Bangladesh, the long-necked women of Myanmar, and how China's String of Pearls plan is playing out in Sri Lanka. Welcome to Asia Calling, and thanks for tuning into the show. It's been a bad year in Bangladesh for bloggers, activists, and anyone in the LGBT community. The government has cracked down on media and civil society, while editors, bloggers, and gay rights activists have been targeted, and in some cases, brutally murdered. It's a state that led 23-year-old Muhammad Raqibul Hassan to flee to Nepal. That's where he met Asia Calling reporter Rajan Parajuli.
Mehmood Raqibul Hassan, or Raqib for short, has been living inside a small meeting room at the Blue Diamond Society. It's a group of activists that supports sexual minorities in the capital, Kathmandu.
I have two blankets. This one for bichhane ke liye.
These are two pieces of cloth. I use one as a mattress and another as a blanket. One Nepali friend gave me them.
Raqib shows me the thin blanket he spreads out on the floor each night. It's winter here, and at night, temperatures hit close to freezing. When I first met Raqib, he hadn't eaten a meal for 3 days. Every few days, he cooks a packet of instant noodles because that's all he can afford. Raqib first fled from home in 2009 after he came out to his parents.
Mom bola, it's like a habit. It's just tumara mentally thinking, tumara thinking change karo.
My mother said, it's not natural, it's just your thinking, so change it. She said, the day I became normal, they will accept me. They took me to the psychiatrist, but the psychiatrist harassed me and told me I was the problem for society. And people like me are the root cause of HIV. He gave me different pills, but things didn't change.
At home, Raqib's father refused to eat with him at the same table. And when he prayed in the mosque, his family told him the seat he had used would remain impure for a month. So Raqib packed up a few belongings, some clothes, a few books, and about $200. And he took the 12-hour bus to Dhaka. In the capital, Raqib and his friends formed a youth organization called Rubban. They published a magazine, wrote blogs, and organized awareness programs, urging people to speak out against discrimination and violence against sexual minorities. They voice against horrific acts such as those he had experienced himself.
The police caught me when I was coming out of the park one day, and they accused me of being a sex worker. They said they will file a case against me. They forcefully took me to a public toilet and started touching me everywhere. They harassed me. I kicked them and they burned cigarettes on my back. They raped me and threw me on the road. I had no one to support me if they filed the case, so I had no choice but to keep quiet.
Before he fled, Raqib was writing for a magazine called Muktamona. That was before the magazine's editor, Abhijit Roy, was killed by Islamic fundamentalists. 8 other bloggers who wrote about gay and lesbian issues were also killed.
He was a blogger. He was killed by fundamental. O LGBT free ek blog ka.
When Islamic fundamentalists killed Abhijit Roy, the founding editor of Muktamona, we were very scared. I also used to write for Muktamona. On the public bus one day, some boys were criticizing me. I said, I'm an equal citizen of Bangladesh. And he said, I know where you live. You will end up like your blogger friends. I will throw acid in your face. That really scared me a lot.
Fearing for his life, Raqib decided to leave. He fled to Nepal in April last year, hoping he might be safer here. Rakib hasn't seen his family for more than 6 years now. They don't even know he's in another country. Rakib tries to call his mother on Skype every week, but she won't pick up.
Every day, maybe they blocked me.
The person you're trying to reach is currently unavailable.
Unavailable. Actually, I tried lots of times. Daily, I tried to call them and reach them, but from there, they have no reply or they have no anything.
Here in Nepal, Rakib has been recognized as a refugee by the Office of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, UNHCR. But for now, he is waiting for a host country to take him in. The other option, returning home, would mean he would have to lie about his sexuality, something he isn't prepared to do. For now, when Rakib misses home, he sings the national anthem softly to himself.
Tomar akash, tomar batash, amar prane, omay amar prane bajay bashi.
For Asia Calling, this is Rajan Parajuli in Kathmandu.
It's believed that only 1% of Myanmar's long-necked women are left. Young people in Myanmar have just rejected the tradition of wearing the heavy metal neck coils, complaining that they're uncomfortable and painful. And for those that do, the neck rings have become more of a tourist attraction. From the capital of Kaya State, Phu Xin Po takes a look at this ancient tradition.
I'm here at Sanwon village where the long neck people live. It's about 30 minutes by car from Lai Kho, the capital of Kaya State. Residents say that in the past all the women here wore breast neck coils as a symbol of their identity. Now only 5 out of 200 women here wear the neck coils. Hello!
Hi!
What is your name?
Mpo. Domo Po.
Oh. Mupo is 15 years old and mother of 5. She is the only one in her family who wears the neck coils.
At first, I didn't get used to it. It was painful. I wanted to take them off, but I was worried that I might lose them. These neck coils mean a lot to me because I inherited them from my grandma. After a week of the pain, I got used to it and I felt all right to wear them.
Mupo has been wearing the neck coils now for 20 years and they never came off, not even when she sleeps. There are 14 rings around her neck, and in total they weigh 12 kilograms. She also wears breast coils around her knees. When I met Mupo, she was busy sewing traditional dresses in her tent to sell to the tourists that visit her village.
Lula, Taimalala with me.
When tourists come to see us, we make some money by selling them these clothes. We depend on the tourism business, as we were unable to farm anymore.
In the time of her ancestor, the breast neck coins were a symbol of identity, beauty and worth. There is no written history of when Kayan women first started wearing the neck rings, but some historians say the tradition dates back to 800 years ago. Mupo again.
In the past, girls who could wear the most numbers of breast neck rings were the most popular among the young men in the village. If a girl didn't wear any neck coils, she would find it difficult to get married.
Traditionally, Kayan girls started to wear neck rings on their fifth birthday. Each year, they will add one more until they were married. But this day, the custom is fading out. In this village, less than 10 women wear the rings. And for those that do, it is mostly for the benefit of tourists. They work in hotels and perform traditional dances for the guests. Others travel to neighboring Thailand and China, where they can also find work in the tourism industry. 33-year-old Mule says she gave the neck rings a try, but she just couldn't get used to it.
I tried to put these brass coils on my neck, but they're too heavy. I couldn't eat, I couldn't open my mouth, I couldn't go to the toilet, and I couldn't sit. I wonder how my aunt, who wears them, could stand these coils.
Instead, Mula sells the brass coins and traditional clothes to tourists. It's mostly Burmese tourists that buy the coins to wear for special occasion, she says.
Some foreigners and also local people from Yangon come to buy these brass neck coils, but the majority of my customers are Kayan villagers. Most Kayan women come to buy these brass neck coils to wear in traditional celebration events, but not to wear for life.
But as the tradition of wearing the rings for life dies out, some say there needs to be an urgent solution to preserve the tradition. Jordan is an advisor of the Kayan Cultural Preservation Group.
We need a master plan for maintaining this cultural heritage. Giving job to these women at hotels is not a solution to maintaining the culture. We need suitable job opportunities for these women to be able to maintain this culture.
Although Mupo says protecting their heritage is important, none of her daughters will wear the neck rings.
I don't know what will happen in the future. This is our ancestral cultural heritage. I want to maintain this culture, but I cannot say whether it will survive.
For Asia Calling, this is Pyu Zimbo in Loai Kor.
You're listening to Asia Calling on KBR. When 3 decades of civil war ended in Sri Lanka 8 years ago, fear and anxiety ebbed and flowed. Today, many feel another threat, the nation's sovereignty. Sri Lanka is in deep debt to China for a port in the city of Hambantota, and the questionable terms of payback have generated a huge outcry. Rick Wasserman has this story from the Sri Lankan port town.
I climb into a minibus with Saminda and his friends. The destination, Hambantota, a seaport on Sri Lanka's southern coast. They're on their way to a protest rally against the government and the Chinese. Today, an agreement will be signed between the government and the Chinese holding company that built the port. The agreement grants China a 198-year lease and 80% of the port's revenue. Unacceptable terms, says MP and opposition leader Udaya Gamanpila.
During previous government's time, we built a seaport here because we know after Kra Canal project in Thailand, Singapore will be a more or less abundant seaport. Then Hambantota going to be the most important seaport in Asia. Because of this strategic importance, with Chinese funding, we built a port here.
Building the port was a good idea, says Gamanpila, but the terms mean the Hong Kong-listed China Merchant Holdings Company, which also operates extensively in mainland China, will practically own the port for the next 200 years.
In 98 years' time, Hambantota will be the most important port in Asia. China will be the biggest superpower in the world. So we can't ask China to go. Even if we ask them to go, they would not do. And We can't force them to leave.
It's only 9 a.m., but the sun is already burning. People are starting to march to the harbor site 7 kilometers away. Passing buses carrying delegates to the signing ceremony are being heckled by the growing crowd, now numbering about 300. Samira and her family own a rice field in a nearby village. She's heard that the government plans to give 15,000 acres to another Chinese company, part of another agreement to build a duty-free export zone at the port. She's worried.
The Chinese have come to our country, and I don't like it. We cannot let the government give away our land and our country. I'm here with people from my village to stop them.
The problem started with the previous government under Mahindra Rajapakse, who took on a wide range of ambitious infrastructure projects, railroads, a new airport, a superhighway, and the Hambantota port. Not being able to finance them, he borrowed from the Chinese, and now it's payback time. Hence the deal to be signed, giving China an income-generating long-term lease on the port. The harbor project is part of China's String of Pearls global strategy. It envisions a number of naval posts along Asia's major commercial sea lanes. And with the opposition playing the nationalist card, the result is playing out now in the form of this growing and possibly violent protest. The marchers get to the first police barricade, sweeping it away, rushing onward. A man connects his mobile phone to a loudspeaker and the live-streamed signing ceremony comes to life. The Chinese ambassador to Sri Lanka, Yi Xian Liang, addresses the audience.
Those projects can solve at least 100,000 jobs for Sri Lanka.
There are those who welcome the Chinese. One of them is construction contractor and advisor to the former housing minister, Tilak Chandrakumara.
If many of our qualified engineers can find work in the export zone, that would be great. I'd like to see them involved in the construction of the zone as well. In any case, I'm sure the Chinese will be here for a long time.
But as the ambassador's comments ring out at the port, protesters are met by another massive police barricade. Water cannons roll forward and wash away some of the crowd. Then tear gas is fired, setting the marchers in retreat. The toll, 1 dead and 40 injured. But a victory of sorts for the protesters has been achieved. The signing is postponed for now. From Hambantota in Sri Lanka, this is Rick Wasserman for Asia Calling.
Finally on Asia Calling, South Korean fried chicken has taken Asia by storm. In Korea, there are so many chicken restaurants that regulations had to be passed to limit the number of these businesses from opening up on just one block. But there's a dark side too, and it's causing some restaurant owners to go broke. Jason Strother has this story from Seoul.
The main difference between American and Korean styles of fried chicken comes down to the marinades. Popular ones here are soy sauce or garlic, but the quintessential Korean flavor is yangnyeom. Lee Sun-young, who runs a chicken and beer restaurant in my neighborhood, squeezes the sweet and spicy sauce over a basket of crispy tenders that he just pulled out of the deep fryer. Unlike Colonel Sanders' original recipe, the ingredients for yangnyeom are no secret.
그냥 저걸 사서 쓰는데 저기에 들어간 거는 뭐 I usually just buy it, but it's made of sugar syrup, pepper paste, ketchup, and paprika powder. Ah, and some other stuff.
There are around 50,000 chicken joints in South Korea. Most are franchises and deliver right to the customer's doorstep via motorbike. It's not unusual for there to be dozens of these restaurants in any residential area. Jung Eun Jung is author of a book on the history of South Korea's chicken industry. She says chicken restaurants exploded onto the scene 20 years ago after the Asian financial crisis, which took a big toll on Korea's economy.
많은 노동자들이 해고를 당하고
A lot of middle-aged men were fired from their jobs then, and many of them opened chicken franchises. So these restaurants became popular not because Koreans like eating fried chicken so much, but because suddenly there were just so many of these places, and then Koreans started eating more chicken.
She explains there is a notion here that if you want to own your own business, you should open a restaurant, even if you have no experience in the food industry or even know how to cook. So entrepreneurs pay for culinary classes at chicken academies run by the franchises. Shin Hyun-ho runs a school in Seoul. He teaches newcomers to the business how to cook as well as manage a franchise. He says it's a competitive industry, but still easy to be successful.
Everyone likes chicken, so there are plenty of customers. And the initial investment doesn't have to be that much. It's up to the new owner.
A low investment is what attracts many entrepreneurs into the chicken business. 3 years ago, Park Shi-kyung took out a $150,000 loan to open his restaurant. The 45-year-old already ran his own sign-making company, but he says he needed to earn more money to support his family.
I am at an age when I need to earn more money so I can pay for my two kids' private education to get them ready for university. But running this kind of business was harder than I thought it would be.
Park's restaurant is one of about 50 chicken places in this neighborhood alone, and he says the competition, as well as the lackluster economy, is making it almost impossible to earn any money.
Well, on average in a month, I don't make any money at all. After paying back the loan, buying ingredients, paying my staff, and paying rent, my profits are zero. Right now, nothing.
Chicken industry book author Jung Eun Jung says Park's situation is typical. Most franchise owners never make a profit. She says they can't close their restaurants either, because if they do, then they really lose everything.
Most chicken restaurant owners use their apartments as collateral when they take out a loan to open their restaurants. So they also lose their homes when the business fails.
Jung estimates that each year, about half of all chicken restaurants in Korea go out of business. But that's not stopping new entrepreneurs from entering the market. A lack of jobs for college graduates has seen restaurant owners get younger and younger, like 31-year-old Lee Sun Young, owner of My Neighborhood Chicken Joint. Lee says he knew how tough the chicken business was when he opened his place 6 months ago. He tells me there's even a phrase to describe the competition between restaurants.
We call it the chicken game. People lower their prices to be competitive, and that ends up putting them out of business.
Lee says business is so far pretty good. He's not playing the chicken game. For Asia Calling, this is Jason Strother in Seoul.
That's all for this edition of Asia Calling. Our program today was produced in the studios of Radio KBR in Jakarta, Indonesia. To find out more about our show, please send us a message on our Asia Calling Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at Asia Calling. You can now also podcast the show. Please go to the iTunes Store and search for Asia Calling and subscribe for free to our weekly episodes. I'm Kate Lamb, back next week with more stories from Asia.